and with Commander Reed's pre-battle instructions and speech ringing in their ears, telling the men that, quote, "You have been desirous to have an opportunity to land on an expedition like the one that is now offered to you. I have the fullest confidence in your success. Burn and destroy the town, and put to death all men who you may find bearing arms, and by no means injure the unarmed and yielding. Gentlemen, I wish you success, and I shall expect you to return in 1.5 hours. And with that, the 370 men embarked, and the boat set out for shore as the remaining gun crews on board the Columbia sent occasional shells towards the beach to cover the landing force. All right, welcome back to the U.S. Naval History Podcast. I'm your host, Chase Dalton. This episode covers the second Sumatran expedition, where the United States Navy metes out some destruction along the Sumatran coastline in response to attacks on American traders. The second part of the second Sumatran expedition is probably a pretty good clue that there was a first Sumatran expedition. And if you guessed that, well, then you're right. And there was, in fact, a podcast episode about the first Sumatran expedition a few months ago. So if you want to go back and listen to that one, you can, although you certainly do not have to because this episode can stand on its own. Quick recap, though, if you didn't listen to the first episode. Sumatra is in what is today Indonesia, and by the early 1800s, when this episode takes place, the island was in the centuries-long process of being very slowly colonized by the Dutch, but for the most part, was not yet colonized. Northern Sumatra became a major trading destination for the United States, mainly because Sumatra was by far the world's biggest pepper producer, and as always, people want their food to taste good. Pepper was the almost perfect long-distance trade good because it was valuable but small, and so you could cram a lot of it in a ship's hold, which was essential to making a voyage worth the cost. Based largely out of Massachusetts, there was a rip-roaring pepper trade, and unimaginable fortunes were being made off of it. Unfortunately for the American traders, the trading fleet had expanded far faster than the Navy, which most definitely did not have the global reach that the major trading powers of Britain, France, and the Netherlands did. So pretty quickly, the local Sumatrans came to realize that the Americans didn't have any muscle behind their trade, and what is an undefended ship other than a hole in the water full of valuable stuff for the taking? And so in 1831, an American merchantman, the Friendship, arrived off the coast of a large village called Kuala Batu, as they had many times before on the annual pepper run. And the captain of the Friendship, he goes ashore to do the usual negotiations over the pepper cargo. But back on the ship, which is offshore a little bit, three small local boats known as proas came out to start trading with the crew still aboard. No big deal, happens every time. But when this particular group of natives got aboard, they killed the Friendship's first officer and two other of her crew, or everybody else aboard the Friendship, had time to dive overboard, and then the natives proceeded to loot the ship. The non-murdered crew members of the Friendship's crew managed to escape to another village nearby, and with the help of a local chief named Poe Adam and some groups of European and American traders in the area, they retook the Friendship and sailed her back to Massachusetts. After reaching Salem, the Friendship's captain tells the story of murder and of piracy. President Andrew Jackson, along with the rest of the general public, were pretty understandably outraged. And so the frigate USS Potomac was sent under Commodore John Downes to punish the Sumatran pirates for their treachery and to belatedly show some American muscle. And so under Commodore Downes, the Potomac reached Kuala Batu on February 5th, 1832. Commodore Downes meets with Poe Adam, the guy who helped out the crew of the Friendship, and Poe Adam sort of gives him the political lay of the land. Downes makes an attempt to negotiate, sort of a give us the murderers, pay some restitution, promise we won't do it again, and we'll make this all go away sort of deal. But he is met in a unfriendly manner and decides, okay then, hard way it is. He sends 282 Marines and sailors ashore, where they basically surround the village of Kuala Batu and then burn it. After engaging in some pretty heavy fighting, they destroy the forts protecting the town, and then they kill about 150 Sumatrans in the process. If you want to hear all the interesting details, they are all there in that episode on the first Sumatran expedition. At this point, Downes and the Potomac leave after giving the pretty clear message that yes, in fact, the United States did have a navy, and yes, we can mess you up, And also, please don't try this again or we'll be back. And after this little display of muscle, trade resumes smoothly for the next 6 years anyway, until the trading ship Eclipse pulls up off the coast of Tangan-Tangan, just up the coastline from Kuala Batu, where the attack on the trading ship Friendship took place 6 years earlier. It's late August, and the captain of the Eclipse sends his first mate, basically the equivalent of an executive officer aboard a ship today, to go negotiate for the village's pepper crop. So far, it's just a normal trading stop. Everything's going well. No big deal. But on the afternoon of August 26th, after a day of negotiating and trading, the surf has risen to a dangerous level, and so the party ashore decided they'll just wait until the next day before taking their small boat back to the ship, which is anchored a mile or two out to sea. Again, for the 5 men ashore, this was totally normal, no big deal. They've been trading with the village all week, they knew everyone, they did this every year. And sure, yeah, I mean, there was that incident 6 years ago, that was one ship quite a while ago. And there'd been sort of a level of comfort and trust developed since this part of the coastline was a regular stop on the Eclipse's annual trade run. So night falls, and at that point, a pair of boats come alongside the Eclipse with about a dozen men in each of them. And they bring with them a bunch of pepper to trade. The second mate recognized the leader of the men on the boats as someone they'd dealt with before in trade negotiations and lets the men aboard, thinking this is just part of the usual trade. At this point, the second mate locks up their weapons per the captain's standing orders and starts weighing out the pepper that the Sumatrans had brought while they wait for the captain to emerge from his cabin. So at about 10 that evening, the captain comes up from his cabin, and he also recognizes the local Sumatrans hanging out, waiting to talk and negotiate with him. And as they talk, the locals sort of complain to the captain about the lack of trust, why'd you have to lock up our weapons, etc., etc. And it was part of Sumatran culture at that time that men carried this sort of wavy, cool-looking dagger called a kris on them at all times, and the captain understands this. And so the captain orders his crew to return the Sumatran's knives, which turns out to be an extraordinarily poor decision on his part. As soon as they get the knives in hand, they immediately attack the captain, they attack the second mate, and the rest of the crew. Most of the crew managed to escape by diving overboard and swimming for it, but one man, the ship's cook, had been locked up below decks for insubordination and was unable to escape. He was in chains, basically. And as the Sumatrans search the ship, they find the cook, and in exchange for his life and freedom, the cook showed the Sumatrans where the ship's money and the valuables were being kept. And so the pirates loaded their boats with valuables and about $27,000 in silver, which at that time was a small fortune, and they sailed away. Some of the survivors of the attack swam for shore, but others managed to climb back aboard the Eclipse after the pirates left. The ship's small boat was lowered, and the men who had not swum for shore rowed down the coast looking for help and eventually found a French trader. The men who swam to shore told the first mate, who is still in the village of Tangan-Tangan, what happened. And the first mate, he then tells the local Raja, or the ruler of Tangan-Tangan, who understood that this was bad news and agreed to help. He sort of remembered what happened just down the coastline at Kuala Batu when some pirates attacked, and he was pretty eager not to be implicated in this. So the next morning, the Raja sent armed boats with the Americans to go recapture the Eclipse. When they arrived, the Eclipse was bloody but deserted. The Americans, they sort of set out sail to prepare to get out of there as fast as possible because who knew if there'd be a repeat. And besides, all the silver and the valuable trade goods were gone, so they couldn't even buy any pepper this year. And that was when the second party of Americans returned, and they also brought some French sailors with them to go recapture the ship. They found it already getting ready to go underway, and so the crew was reunited without the murdered men and without the captain, obviously, who was among the murdered men, and the Eclipse sails for home to Salem. A month later, the frigate Columbia and the corvette John Adams sailed into the harbor at Colombo in what is today Sri Lanka, just south of India. These two ships made up the U.S. Navy's newly formed East India Station Squadron. It was a very small squadron, but it did show that the United States Navy was taking its first steps towards becoming a global force, you know, as obviously befitted a rising nation. And the squadron was commanded by the captain of the Columbia, Commodore George Reed. Now, Commodore Reed was a pretty solid veteran of the Navy at this point. He was appointed as a midshipman in 1804, and so he just missed service in the First Barbary War. But he was just in time to serve as a lieutenant during the War of 1812, under an absolute legend of the early United States Navy, Captain Isaac Hull. Then Lieutenant Reed led gun crews during the fight between the USS Constitution and the HMS Guerriere in 1812. His next ship was the USS United States, where he served under another legend of the early Navy, Captain Stephen Decatur. During that frigate's victory over HMS Macedonian in 1813. And I talk about all these engagements in my War of 1812 episode if you want to dig into the back catalog. By the end of the War of 1812, Lieutenant Reed had been promoted and had command of his own small 16-gun brig, which he sailed into the Mediterranean with Bainbridge, yet another legend, and was part of the squadron that defeated the Barbary States during the Second Barbary War, which there's also an episode on that back in the back catalog. So basically, Commodore Reed was a battle-hardened veteran who had served with the absolute who's who of the first generation of U.S. naval officers. He was promoted again to captain in 1825, and at that point, he was given the title of Commodore of the East India Squadron. He was the squadron's first Commodore. When he arrived in Colombo, he read the news about the attack on the Eclipse in a newspaper. And there was obviously no such thing as radio, and the United States Navy lacked the worldwide system of mail and official communication ships that the British, for example, had. But the report in the paper was credible, and with that, on December 1st, 1839, Commodore Reed recalled the sailors and Marines from the Columbia and the John Adams back from shore leave and left with the tide for the coastline of Sumatra. During the voyage from the Indian Ocean to the coast of Sumatra, the crew trained and they drilled with small arms and melee weapons. They set up targets on the ship's deck to practice their marksmanship with what one crewman described as, quote, full expectation of having a brush with these Malayan desperados upon our arrival, end quote. 15 days later, the squadron of two arrived off the northern tip of Sumatra, and they began to beat their way south along the coastline to the scene of the attack. And they came across a couple groups of trading ships who confirmed the news of the attack on the Eclipse. And they also warned the squadron that the locals were absolutely not to be trusted under any circumstances. There had been a number of similar attacks over the years that had necessitated similar punitive expeditions over the years by the British and Dutch to avenge their merchants. And the traders told the squadron that they needed to be ready for anything. On the afternoon of December 22nd, the squadron arrived at the village of Kuala Batu, the village that had been the scene of the first attack back in 1832. The Columbia and the John Adams dropped anchor for the night after what was no doubt an extremely stressful night for the inhabitants and the rulers of Kuala Batu. Dawn broke, and with it came a small boat that approached the two waiting warships. Aboard the boat was none other than the longtime friend of the Americans, Poe Adam, who was well known to a couple of sailors in the squadron since, in those days, sailors from the civilian trade fleets often moved back and forth into and out of the naval service. Some of the sailors had definitely been in the area before, and I haven't been able to get 100% confirmation on this, but I believe that there were a few seamen aboard who were part of the first Sumatran expedition 6 years ago. Regardless, Poe Adam was given a very warm welcome, and after some introductions, he told the wardroom of officers that they had come to the right place. The Raja of Kuala Batu was indeed sheltering a pirate in the village, and this pirate had brought $2,000, which was his share of the booty, to the village. Poe Adam also told the wardroom more about the attack on the Eclipse, as well as exactly who was responsible for its planning, and about which Rajas had given the go-ahead for the attack. Furthermore, he told Commodore Reed that the ringleaders of the attack had coordinated it all in Mukki, which was the biggest city in that area, and that some of the pirates were openly living and boasting and spending their stolen loot freely in the city, and that there were also a couple more pirates in the smaller village of Susu as well. Since the squadron was already off the coast of Kuala Batu, and There was at least one pirate there. Commodore Reed decided he might as well send a party ashore. And so despite Poe Adam assuring the Commodore that it was safe to just send an unarmed negotiating party, Commodore Reed definitely took the, I would say, smart and cautious approach and sent a large group of armed sailors and Marines over the side and into the Columbia's small boat, which then rowed the 3 miles to shore. When the boat arrived on the shoreline, the reception they got was pretty similar to the one the Potomac's first boat received back in 1832, which is to say that they were met by a large group of well-armed and aggressive men on the beach line. But not to be deterred, Lieutenant Palmer, who led the initial landing party, wrote that with his group and Poe Adam, quote, "The boat was driven boldly onto the beach, and the three officers jumped, without hesitation, into the midst of the wild and armed multitude," end quote. The landing party was immediately surrounded, but the Americans pushed their way through towards the Raja's main village fortress, which also served as the Raja's home, similar to the combination castle-palace concept of medieval Europe, although these generally were wooden stockade fortresses instead of big stone castles like you might be picturing in Europe. Moving into the fortress, Lieutenant Palmer met with the Raja and explained that the Commodore, and in fact that the government of the United States, wanted to remain friends with the village of Kuala Batu. However, after the attack on the Eclipse, that friendship was now in doubt. And, you know, the subtext being, wouldn't it be terrible if we weren't friends anymore? Because, after all, you're no doubt aware of what happened last time. Lieutenant Palmer insisted that the Raja turn over the pirate who was living in the village and return the stolen $2,000 that was in the village. The Raja, of course, professed his continued friendship and innocence because, really, what else could you do with two warships just offshore? But said that he wasn't sure if he would be able to take the pirate into custody because the pirate had a lot of friends in the village and any attempt to capture him would likely end in a fight or early warning, which would just let the pirate escape. So it's like getting late in the afternoon at this point, and the Americans were eager to get back before nightfall because safety was still going to be an issue at night. You don't want to be surrounded by potential enemies. But the Raja promised to try and capture the pirate during the night. And so now, here's where I admit the limits of my own research. I am primarily pulling from and quoting extensively from Small Boats and Daring Men, Maritime Raiding, Irregular Warfare, and the Early American Navy by the excellent historian Benjamin Armstrong. And I'm not sure if any written records of this incident from the Sumatran point of view exist. But if they do, I haven't been able to locate them or even a secondary source which references them. And so I'm relying exclusively on American and European sources for this episode. That being said, there's some assumptions I can make since they are universally true ones about human nature. One is that there were politics being played on the Sumatran side as well as on the American side. The Sumatran society was not a tightly centralized state, even by the standards of the 19th century. The Raja had to think about the short-term immediate threat, aka keep my village from being blown off the map again by the Americans, as well as the longer-term consequences he could face from the other Rajas if he threw them under the bus once the American warships were long gone. And then he had to also think internally about the internal pressures he would face inside of his own village if he wanted to remain as Raja. And then we also have Poe Adam. He had proven himself again and again and again as a friend of the Americans, but he probably had his own agenda as well. He was a local chieftain, and of course, it put him in a powerful position to be the primary and trusted intermediary between Americans and Sumatrans. I don't find any reason in any of the accounts not to believe that Poe Adam was anything other than truthful and helpful, but Poe Adam was already a prominent trader and a member of society, and doubly so now that he was holding a powerful position as interpreter and intermediary. And there's a lot of ways to leverage a situation where you have the implicit backing of a country with two big warships off your coastline. And then, of course, Poe Adam also had to think about a situation after the American warships were long gone. And all this is to say that some of the information and advice may very well have been skewed to making sure that the wrong people didn't end up in too bad a position. And since, again, Poe Adam was a local leader as well, perhaps to make sure that his clan ended up in a good position after the dust settled. But the thing is, I can't be sure. I can be reasonably sure what the major players on the American side were thinking and why they did what they did, because they all conveniently wrote letters and reports and memoirs and books and filled out after-action reports, and those were all conveniently written in English. And most of those have been conveniently enough preserved in various internet-accessible archives. I can't take those at 100% face value, but most of the reasoning and the motivations are very clear, and they're consistent across multiple people and sources on the American side. But any Sumatran sources either seem to have never been written down, or they didn't survive, or they were never put online or referenced, or perhaps they just were never studied by a scholar who then wrote about the Sumatran point of view in English. And so I'm left with what essentially is a lot of guesswork on this front. So back to the action. Lieutenant Palmer is back aboard the Columbia. He makes his report that the Raja admitted that a pirate was in his village, but also that the Raja, he seemed friendly, definitely wanted to remain on good terms with the Americans to prevent round two from destroying his village again. But Lieutenant Palmer also reported that he had some serious doubts that the Raja would so much as attempt to capture the pirate. And so with that, Commodore Reed began planning for the next day with the assumption that the Raja would not deliver. He organized a second party to visit the fort, and this time it was under the command of Commodore Wyman, who was the commanding officer of the John Adams, the other smaller ship in the squadron. Commodore Reed told Commander Wyman to go ashore the next morning with a group of armed men and make it crystal clear to the Raja that while the United States definitely wanted to remain friends, it would be the Raja's actions which determined if that was going to be possible. If the Raja did not or could not produce the pirate and the stolen money, the United States would have to work on the assumption that any trust and friendship that had existed was broken and gone. So the next morning, Commodore Wyman went ashore with his men and with Poe Adam to deliver his message to the Raja. And to nobody's surprise, the Raja had failed to capture the pirate in the night and claimed that the pirate had escaped. How true this is and how seriously the Raja had tried to capture the pirate is probably lost to history. But the Raja did tell Commander Wyman that he'd sent a group of men after the pirate and that he had sent messengers to the other local villages to ask their Rajas to help capture the pirate. And again, those micro-local politics of the situation are probably lost to history, but it is clear that nobody on the American side seemed particularly surprised about this outcome. And so Commander Wyman delivered the pre-planned ultimatum that the Raja had until sunset to produce the murderers and the money. And if he did not, the Raja would be responsible for breaking the peace between his village and the government of the United States. So with his audience complete, Commander Wyman and his guard returned to their boats via a meandering route through the village, which served the dual purpose of showing off American firepower and also allowing a little reconnaissance of the village and its defenses. And while they're taking the scenic route through the village, a lower-level chieftain who the officers recognized from the Raja's audience stopped them, and he introduced himself as Poe Nya Haight. Poe Nya Haight was probably sensing a combination of danger and opportunity here, and he assured the officers that he personally and his clan wanted to remain friends with the United States, and that his clan hadn't fought against the Potomac 6 years earlier. And Poe Nya Haight was invited aboard the Columbia to meet with Commodore Reed, and once on board, he again said that he wanted to be friends with the United States and with the Commodore, and told Commodore Reed that the Raja of the village not only had the money, but he also could have taken the pirate had he wanted to. And so Poe Nya Haight asked if he could bring his family on board the ship if hostilities were going to begin, because after all, a decent portion of the village had been killed during the last round in the first Sumatran expedition. So before answering, Commodore Reed asked Poe Nya Haight what he would do if the ship destroyed the town, and Chief replied that, oh, well, I'm just going to return to the village, and me and my clan, we're going to take control, and then I'll become the new Raja, and, quote, I befriend to America, end quote. He even offered his men to fight alongside an American landing party and said that the Americans could use his fort as a base of operations. And so the officers went, they talked with Poe Adam about the man, and Poe Adam seemed to like the idea and suggested that you know, with some support from the Americans, the village of Kuala Batu could probably undergo a regime change. However, Commodore Reed decided that wasn't quite the line of attack he wanted to pursue, and so he declined Po Nai Hate's offer of a direct alliance, but he said, you can definitely bring your family on board in case of any difficulties. And so as the day wore on, the Raja certainly didn't seem to be any closer to producing the pirate who had killed the Americans. And so at sunset approaching, Commodore Reed ordered the gunner to open fire. As cannonballs began streaking towards the village, the waiting villagers all began to scramble away, doing the sensible thing. The Raja's fort returned fire, but at 3 miles out, the ships were just out of range of the smaller cannons in the fort, and those cannonballs fell short, which meant that the Columbia and the John Adams could fire at long range, at will, with impunity, from their own naval guns. In this era, and really through essentially all of the gunnery era, naval guns were almost always larger and more powerful than their land-based equivalents, because those land-based equivalents are really hard to move, whereas you can move the naval guns just by moving the ship. For 30 minutes, the ships pounded away at the village. They focused on the forts, on the village bazaar, and on the foliage with grape shot and cancer shot, which is basically giant shotgun shell ammunition for cannons, to clear out all that undergrowth and trees which bordered the village, to basically clear out any area that could be used to hide and ambush any landing party. After 30 minutes of bombardment, Commodore Reed gave the order to cease fire, and through telescopes it was clear that their precautions to clear out the underbrush on the border of the village was well planned. Men armed with muskets began to come out from their hiding places, apparently having given up on the planned ambush of any sunset landing party. The smoldering village forts, they all raised white flags, and further down the coastline, the village of Susu and another village apparently took an opportunity to preemptively surrender as well with white flags from their own forts. With white flags flying from the shore and light fading, Commodore Reed sent his men to bed because, after all, it was Christmas Eve. The next day was Christmas Day, and despite some grumbling from the men who were eager for action, Commodore Reed again decided that he was in no hurry to land troops. Time was on his side, and I can only imagine the tension that the Raja must have been feeling waiting for Commodore Reed's next move. Po Nai Hiat again offered to fight alongside the Americans if they planned to land. But after thinking about it on a restful Christmas day, Commodore Reed decided that since the pirate and his looted $2,000 were almost certainly gone at this point, and there was probably little to be gained from sending a landing party ashore. Furthermore, the "don't harbor pirates in your village" point had been sufficiently made again. He could always come back later for that. So Commodore Reed ordered his men to weigh anchor and set sail for the village of Mucky, where Poe Adam claimed that the ringleaders of the attack on the Eclipse were living, and where the attack had been sanctioned by the local Raja. The small squadron slowly made their way down the coastline and dropped anchor off of Mucky on December 30th. Mucky was bigger than Kuala Batu, and it was the biggest village slash a small city on this section of coastline, and it had fields and steep mountains rising behind it. The city was guarded by several cannon-armed forts. So again, Commodore Reed sent Commander Wyman ashore with an armed party of men to negotiate, this time with the Raja of Mucky. And again, Commodore Wyman explained that the squadron was investigating the attack on the Eclipse and demanded that the local leaders turn over those who took part in the attack, as well as any stolen money in the village. After the usual and the expected denials, including that the Raja was not responsible for the people who lived in his village and what they may or may not have done to foreigners, negotiations were broken off until the next day. The next day, Commodore Wyman goes back, and essentially no more progress is made in the negotiations. And in Commander Wyman's report to his Commodore, he was of the opinion that the negotiations at this point were useless. Commodore Reed agreed, and he later wrote that, quote, "Satisfied that they did not mean to comply with my demands for the persons concerned in the piracy, I directed all preparations to be made," end quote. So he set the crew to work, catching the ships closer and closer to shore to prepare for bombardment. So kedging is not really something we do anymore, but back in the Age of Sail, it was a very careful and slow way to move a ship closer to shore when you can't rely on sail power due to the dangerous shoal conditions or the wind not lining up right. And it's basically where the ship's small boats load the anchor onto the boat. They row out a bit. They drop the anchor down, which will then anchor to the seafloor. And the anchor chain aboard the ship is taken in. And in the process, it doesn't drag the anchor to the ship, but it drags the ship to the anchor. And so it advances a couple hundred yards. And you repeat this as many exhausting times as necessary to very slowly and carefully and labor-intensively move the ship forward a little bit. And so the crews of the Columbia and the John Adams spent New Year's Eve, 1838, slowly kedging the ship closer and closer to shore to within 200 yards, which is absolute point-blank cannon range of Muckie. For the residents and leaders of the city, this must have been a quite ominous sight, having these giant gunships just get slowly closer and closer, knowing that they had far more firepower than you could possibly deliver. And part of why I imagine Reed was doing this was to give every opportunity for the Raja to, produce the pirates and produce the money, right? This is a very slow motion threat getting closer and closer, but eventually it seemed clear that there was going to be no last minute offer of cooperation coming forth as the ships maneuvered into their firing positions. But the crews did observe a steady stream of village inhabitants carrying off their valuables and disappearing into the jungle-covered mountains. By 10 o'clock, both ships were in position to begin bombardment. Commodore Reed beat his ship to quarters and at 1100 ordered his squadron to open fire. Columbia focused her fire on the forts, and both ships rotated their round-shot canister and grape, which shredded the coconut groves and thinly constructed buildings around the village bazaar. As noon approached, Reed ordered a ceasefire. After an hour of bombardment, silence stretched out over the wreckage of Muckie. The Commodore ordered his landing party called away. Six boats carrying three divisions of men from the Columbia and four boats from John Adams carrying two divisions embarked their men on the seaward side of the ships to prevent any pot shots from the village from hitting the men as they climbed down the rope ladders into the waiting small boats. Leading the landing party, Commodore Wyman boarded one of the boats from the John Adams, and with Commander Reed's pre-battle instructions and speech ringing in their ears, telling the men that, quote, "You have been desirous to have an opportunity to land on an expedition like the one that is now offered to you. I have the fullest confidence in your success. Burn and destroy the town, and put to death all men who you may find bearing arms, and by no means injure the unarmed and yielding. Gentlemen, I wish you success, and I shall expect you to return in 1 hour and a half." And with that, the 370 men embarked, and the boat set out for shore as the remaining gun crews on board the Columbia sent occasional shells towards the beach to cover the landing force. The boats landed at the harbor's edge, about 150 yards from the village itself. The Marines landed first and took up defensive positions facing the town. The divisions cleared their boats and began to form up on the beach. By 12:30, the force was formed, but to their surprise, there was no sniper fire or resistance on the beach, like the first expedition had experienced when they landed 6 years earlier. If anything, the impression made by the first expedition may have made the second's job easier, because it appeared that the stream of villagers heading out of the village and into the mountains had restarted. Much like Captain Downes' plan at Kuala Batu 6 years earlier, Commodore Wyman split off his divisions to assault the village's forts. However, unlike 6 years prior at Kuala Batu, this time the forts were largely empty and provided no resistance. The ambushes that the Marines feared as they entered the stockades did not materialize, and the forts fell to the landing force easily. The guns were quickly and easily spiked, and the divisions charged with taking the forts moved on. So here I just want to make a quick historical aside about spiking the guns. And so how this would be done is a crew would take a spike, which and it's barbed so it can only go in one way. They would hammer this barbed steel spike into the torch hole, which is how you ignite the cannon to fire it. And You can only remove this spike with great difficulty and probably by destroying the cannon. This was a very fast and effective way of destroying an expensive piece of military equipment when you either captured it and didn't want to bring it with you, or you couldn't bring it with you, or also if you had time to spike a cannon before you retreated so that the enemy could not capture it. So this is essentially what we Americans were doing to the Sumatran's cannons, because they were sort of old, and also we didn't really have the capacity or the will to take them, so we were just rendering these very expensive pieces of military equipment useless as a little bit of a punitive thing, but also to remove any threat that these cannons would later pose to the Americans. The most famous example of spiking cannons in history, of course, is probably at the Battle of Waterloo, which was Napoleon's final demise. And the situation is set. It's a battle against the British, and the French infantry reserves were committed when Marshal Ney, who was the bravest of the brave, Napoleon's most trusted lieutenant, ordered a mass cavalry assault. And these riders, they go up the hill towards the British artillery, and the British infantry, they form squares, so to anti-cavalry defensive positions. And these 9,000 French cavalry, they charge up the hill. And Wellington's artillery, the British general's artillery, they responded with canister and shot, and they're just tearing chunks through the French cavalry. But then they retreat to the inside of the square rather than get run over and just slaughtered with swords. And at that point, Marshal Ney's aide is just frantically yelling, you know, spike the guns, nail, spike the guns, but not a single one of these cavalry riders had brought the spikes with them. And so 11 times the French cavalry, they gain the hill and they surround the guns to basically stop the artillery from firing. But they're under sporadic fire from these defensive infantry squares. And so they have to retreat. And then the gunners, they go back to their cannons. And so then they fire on the French cavalry as it withdraws. And so again and again, the French cavalry, they attack, but they don't have the spikes. And so they can't disable the cannons. And this is famously considered one of the turning points of the Battle of Waterloo, and for lack of some spikes with which to disable the British cannon, that allows the Prussians to have time to reinforce the British, and at this point, it was all over. Napoleon couldn't defeat the combined British and Prussian forces. He had to defeat the British before the Prussians arrived, and for lack of a few spikes, Napoleon was defeated at Waterloo. Back to the action at Mucky. One division was broken off with torches to begin setting fire to the bazaar, which they also discovered abandoned and cleared of valuables. They moved on to the elaborately carved gate of the main fort and the Raja's home, and the sailors and marines there also found it abandoned. The Raja's cannons were spiked, and his fort-slash-home combo were set ablaze like the others. With all five of Mucky's forts taken, and 22 cannons spiked and dismounted, the divisions began to reassemble. By 1400, Mucky was in the possession of the Americans and burning. A last group of small local boats were set afire for good measure, as the Americans embarked on their own boats to return to the Columbia and to the John Adams. Without a single casualty, the Americans returned to their ships, and by 2:30, the operation was complete. Commander Wyman wrote, quote, "Nothing remained visible to the eye but the ashes covering the smoking ruins upon the site on which the town of Mucky and the forts once stood," end quote. Seemed like everything that could be done at Mucky had been done, and that there wasn't much left to say. And now it was time to deal with a third village harboring pirates, the much smaller village of Susu. At Susu, the usual process of diplomacy with the village Raja began. The Americans demanded that the locals turn over the pirates, but at this point, they were well aware that this was unlikely to happen, since neither Kuala Batu nor Mucky's leaders had complied. It was obvious that the Americans were capable of leveling the much smaller and weaker forts of Susu. But at this point, Commodore Reed decided he would try the diplomatic tact. Given that, as usual, the local leaders assured him that they definitely wanted to comply with Reed's demand to turn over the pirates, but that they just didn't have the power to do so. Drawing the lesson of the failed peace through display of military strength shown by Commodore Downes during the first expedition, Commodore Reed was determined to pursue something a little more lasting this time. It was clear from the white flags flying from every village they passed on the coast that everybody understood the power that the Americans could bear. But how long would this last? A solution came in the form of the second largest village in the area, after the now destroyed Mucky, which was Kuala Batu. The Raja of Kuala Batu certainly did not want the Americans to return to his village, especially after hearing about the raising of Mucky. And the Raja was also a trader, and he understood the economics involved in the situation and how he could turn a bad situation into a good one. Mucky had been the largest of the local trading villages, but it was currently defenseless and a smoldering pile of rubble, and certainly would not be open for business in the near future. And so that left Kuala Batu as the biggest remaining village in the area, and now the number one natural stop for any American or European trade ships, as long as the Raja could keep the Americans from leveling his village as well. The potential for economic gain or loss for the village became even more obvious when two European pepper traders, which arrived on the coast, were ordered back by Commodore Reed because he had this section of coastline under blockade. Using Poatam and the leaders of Susu as intermediaries, the Raja of Kuala Batu sued for what he certainly hoped would be a very profitable and mutually beneficial peace treaty between his village and the United States. And while he did not acknowledge receiving any of the pirated money, he did concede that it was, you know, possible, I guess, that $2,000 of it may have come into his village. He still wasn't able to place the pirate into American custody, but he did offer to repay that $2,000 as an offer of goodwill. Unfortunately, though, since the village was under blockade, the Raja couldn't sell his pepper crop, and so he didn't have that much money just sitting around. But if the Americans were to lift the blockade and leave the village attacked, then he would definitely be in a position to pay the sum in 1 year's time to any American vessel designated to receive it. I mean, heck, with Mucky removed from the pepper trade, if the Raja of Kuala Batu could pull this off, his village would probably be better off than ever despite the American bombardment. And as for Commodore Reed, it seemed clear that while he could continue to burn and pillage the coastline at will, it didn't seem like this would yield either the pirates or the missing money. And it might go so far as to create some long-term hostility that would endanger American merchantmen more. So if he could instead co-opt the local Raja of Kuala Batu as a local enforcer of American interests and a protector of American lives and property in the future, that would go a lot farther in protecting American lives and interests than a few more rounds of bombardment. So Commodore Reed put on his diplomat hat and acted with the broad diplomatic authority in the way that actually a lot of American naval officers did in that age, which was well before the United States had embassies with most countries, and where naval officers were often the highest ranking, if not the only, U.S. government official presence in the area. And even if you wanted to get word back to Washington, it was more than a year-round trip, and so that was obviously impractical. Commodore Reed, with his diplomatic hat on, had what amounted to a peace treaty drawn up. It described the events that had taken place, including the attack on the Eclipse and the bombardment of Kuala Batu. It included the $2,000 that the Raja would pay in 1 year's time, and that the Raja would, quote, "do hereby pledge ourselves to suffer no American vessel be molested hereafter, and by all means in our power to prevent all wicked designs for annoying or in any way injuring them," end quote. And also that the Raja would be obligated to warn the Americans of any attack he knew about. He'd be obligated to defend any Americans under attack. And he'd also be obligated to capture any attackers who did manage to attack any Americans. The implicit threat behind all of this was that now that we have a signed treaty, if you break it, don't expect any mercy from the third Sumatran expedition. And so both the Raja and the Commodore signed the document, and given the degree of, you know, mercy, or at least non-destruction shown to Kuala Batu, and the ongoing blockade of the whole area of coastline, Commodore Reed was soon approached by representatives from other local Rajas who said that they too would absolutely love the opportunity to sign a similar treaty under similar terms, if only they could go back to making money from the incoming pepper traders. And so after signing agreements with the other Rajas in the area, Commodore Reed lifts the blockade, conveniently just in time for an American pepper trader who had assisted him with the negotiations and interpretation to contract a great deal on the sudden glut of pepper in the surrounding villages for their voyage home. And with that, the two ships from the U.S. East India Station left the coast of Sumatra on January 14th, 1839, northbound for the Strait of Malacca, and would spend the next year and a half deployed, circumnavigating the world before returning to Boston on June 13th, 1840. The U.S. East India Squadron traveled 55,000 nautical miles in defense of American interests in the Indian and Pacific Oceans, and were part of what allowed American pepper merchants to go on to dominate the trade on the Sumatran coast. No American ship was ever again attacked through the Civil War era, when the American domination of the pepper trade was eventually overtaken by American rivals as we were distracted by war. And so that is it. That is the second Sumatran expedition. I hope you enjoyed it. If you haven't listened to the first one, go back and listen to that. If anything, it is a little bit more interesting with, you know, more battles, I guess, taking place. Although the lesson could be that the pen is mightier than the sword. But regardless, I would love a rating. And so basically on Spotify, on iTunes, those are the two big ones. But anywhere else that you listen, if you're able to give a rating, I would appreciate a 5-star one. Also on iTunes, if you haven't left a written rating, I would absolutely love that. You know, something about why you like it, only because it helps other people find the podcast, sort of helps with the internal iTunes algorithm distribution. So if you could do that, I would really appreciate it. And until next time, you can always email me, usnavalhistorypodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, fair winds the following season.